Live and in color from the NBC News Radio Broadcasting Studios of KCAA, 1050 AM, 102.3 FM, and 106.5 FM, located in beautiful Southern California and in parallel from the Turf's Up Radio Studio in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Thanks for tuning in to the Water Zone show this evening. Well, hello again and welcome to the Water Zone, another episode, another day, and I'm here with Chris Stavey and... Chris, how are you doing today?
Good evening, Rob. Doing great. Thank you very much. Just reacting to how I see there's a synergy between the weather and the stock market this week here.
Yeah,
we're tracking down.
We're tracking that very nicely.
We are. All right, so we got our mics working here, a little shenanigans in the booth there. But
he's waving to us. Should we wave back to him?
Yep,
can you hear us? We can hear you.
Here we go. All right, guys. So we got a our regular guest on tonight. Her name is Chris Maven.
Yep.
Chris Austin from Maven's Notebook. Chris, I think you're on the line.
You're changing your name already.
Hey, guys. How are you doing? Can you hear me?
We had some headphone problems here, and their engineers frantically running around trying to boost.
Are you there, Chris?
Yeah, I'm there. Can
awesome.
You hear me?
Yes, we can. Just fine.
Okay, cool.
Had a couple of inputs and outputs here in the wrong place, so we're okay now.
Yeah, I know. I remember that look you get on your face when like the audio ain't happening and it's supposed to be happening.
Well,
and,
it worked on the mic check, so
yeah.
Gremlins.
So
it's like, they're still alive and well.
Well, Chris, you've been a recording engineer. You know the famous line we always gave everybody: "We'll fix it in the mix."
Fix it in the mix.
Yeah. Unfortunately, this is a live show, so we don't have that choice. So, anyway, welcome. I see there's lots of news like every single week in water, but I understand the Indian tribes are getting really angry about some stuff.
Well, they don't like the Delta Tunnel project.
No.
That should not be a surprise.
No.
They kind of have a different view about water, and, to most Indian tribes, the best use of water is, flowing in the river,
mm-hmm.
right? Because they're very much connected to the rivers up there and the salmon in there, and the salmon aren't doing well. And so they perceive that the Delta tunnels are a threat to the salmon. And so, they've been out, protesting, I guess. DWR held a meeting up in Redding. Pretty much because the people north of Sacramento said, you're not holding a meeting up here, and you should, and a lot of tribes wanted to participate. And, what's actually kind of, I think it's kind of neat about the state of California is that, the state, as a state policy, is trying to consult with Native American tribes. And there's, you could do a whole show, a whole evening on, tribal issues. But, long story short, there are federally recognized tribes and there are tribes that aren't federally recognized, but they are still tribes. And California recognizes all the tribes within our borders, whether you're state or whether you're whether you're federally recognized or not. And they have really been putting forth a policy to try and consult with them and talk to them about things that they're doing. Doesn't mean that the tribe can, kill a project necessarily, but their input is to be taken into consideration. And there are several state policies. Governor Brown actually, started this policy. Enacted, I think, back in by executive order back in like 2009, and Newsom actually last year issued an executive order that was a formal apology to the Native American tribes for the state policies that were discriminatory towards them, and some of the really rather awful things that happened in the past. And he issued this formal apology and set up a Truth and Healing Commission. So long story short, the state's really tried to, consult with the tribes. And I think we're probably, while I can't speak for other states, I imagine we're probably a little more progressive than some of the other states. So that's kind of good. So they've been, you know, so they've been taking that into consideration. The big news, I think, this week has been that they did a report, Dr. Sunding out of the University of California, Berkeley, looking at the impact of water regulations on the Central Valley. And while they said Central Valley, I think it was a little more focused on the San Joaquin Valley. And while they said the impact of California regulations, or, you know, impact of water regulations, they were pretty much talking about SGMA and the ability to get water out of the Delta. And they forecast a lot of doom and gloom. Ever since they passed the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, everybody's been trying to estimate how many acres of irrigated ag is going to have to come out. And the state has 11 million acres of irrigated agriculture. And I have heard, in the beginning, it was like 500,000 to 2 million. And now people are kind of thinking it's going to be more like 2 million to 3 million acres that are going to have to come out of production. And that is going to, you know, that's going to have a factor.
Oh,
so there are those that say that, you know, if the state does certain things, you know, there are certain efficiencies and certain things that that can be done to soften the blow, to make it easier for farmers to, you know, move water around and transfer and, you know, kind of get into watertight areas. But I think it's kind of indisputable that, you know, a substantial amount of acres are going to come out of production as a result.
Do you see more court filings?
Yeah, you know, I think it's going to continue. I mean, already, well, we have one lawsuit filed against the federal biological opinions,
right,
the rules that run the project, and I've heard there's going to be more coming. I can't, you know, people just don't say, oh, state filed the lawsuit, okay, they got our backs. No, no, no. There'll be more lawsuits coming. I do believe the NRDC is going to file one at some point here, probably pretty soon. And there have been some basins that have where the water users in the basins that are unhappy with their groundwater sustainability plan because they have to cut back pumping are now filing, are trying to go to court, filing adjudications, trying to, you know, get around this law in some way. And theoretically the law's been written so that SGMA can proceed, but the courts can, you know, do their thing, and it's all supposed to be sort of, you know, a little less time-consuming and expensive. But we'll see. This is all new stuff, all new ground.
Well, there's a lot of challenges going on right now. I mean, every day, the daily blog on your site, the first headline on there was, you know, it should have said Newsom and Trump, you know, locked in arm wrestling over the negotiating table, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, and all these lawsuits have really put the whole voluntary agreement process into question. And that's the process where all these interests in, you know, the Sacramento Valley and some of the people in the San Joaquin Valley are coming together and trying to put together a comprehensive plan to address the problems with the species and the water, and they want habitat. They're funding money for science. It's, you know, Jeff Keitlinger, the general manager at Metropolitan Water
right.
District, says that his career he's never seen anything like this. It's very comprehensive. I haven't either, to be honest. I'm only 12 years in, 13 years in. You know, the water users are actually agreeing to pay, like, up to $7 an acre foot to go towards this program. And that's actually kind of amazing because usually they don't pony up, you know, cash.
Yeah.
So, you know, we'll have to see. It's still a very fluid process, pun intended.
Well, I knew you were going to weave that. I don't know how you weave that in, but that was great.
Yeah,
I know. Well, I think you have another guest coming up at some point. I can't remember your email.
Yeah, we do. It's a gentleman named Bill Alley and his wife Rosemary.
Oh, yes. And you're right. And they've written the book.
Yes. Yes.
Yes.
And Bill's been on our show before, but he's got this new book that was pretty interesting, so we wanted to get him back on and let him tell our listeners what it's about. He has a great background. He was the chief of the groundwater for the U.S. Geological Survey for almost 20 years. So he's got good experience, and it'll be a great interview. So, you know, all these things I keep, you know, and you do a great job of documenting everything every day. And I don't know how you keep up with it all. It's amazing. But I just don't understand why our legislators can't get together and just solve some of these simple little problems. They're not simple. They're hard. But they make it even more difficult with all the red tape and all the arguing and all the things. And there are people still in Central California aren't getting clean water. And, you know, we're going to build a tunnel, but, you know, 10 years go by, we're still going to build a tunnel.
You've even got an article on Maven's Notebook that says, hey, collaboration is the new game in California water.
Oh, yeah. You know, I was at the Kern County Water Summit yesterday out in Bakersfield, and, you know, that's sort of the, you know, that's the new buzzword, I guess. You know, a lot of people got up there and said, you know, the only way we're going to get out of this is collaborate. You're going to sit down with people who feel differently than you, and you're going to hash these things out. I mean, it really is the only way. Unless we can find those unicorns that spill water from their horns and send them out into the Central Valley to do that. If can't find them, then, you know, we just have a finite amount of water, and, you know, the people in the Central Valley want to be sent more surface water, but, you know, we don't necessarily have all the water that everybody wants for everything, you know, and so there are just tons and tons of trade-offs.
Yeah, there's so many interests in the whole plan, right? The California Water Plan, and, you know, you talk about all the different people involved and all the coalitions and councils and conservancies and, you know, so many people with polar interests here.
You know, we need somebody to be the leader and bring these people together and say, look, we all have different opinions, and everybody has, I want to believe, a valid, true belief in what they say and what they feel. But I would like to see a leader bring them together and put them in a building and say, guess what? You're not leaving until you solve this thing. Just like we pay, we pay representatives from the state to work and stuff like that. They gotta force the issue. They have to be able to bring people to the table and negotiate and say, look, we're not going to get everything 100% we want, and neither is the other side, but we got to come to an agreement somewhere in the middle.
I seem to remember a story about Pat Mulroy, this woman that led the Las Vegas Southern Nevada Water Authority, doing something just about that, you know, just blocking them all in there. And, you know, which was interesting because representing Nevada, they have the smallest share of water in the Colorado River. I mean, it's only like 300,000 acre feet. I mean, that's like nothing.
No, I know.
You know? And yet she was able to put everybody in the same room and make them negotiate, you know, because Nevada needed a solution, you know. So they, you know, even for that little bit of water is very important to them. So, you know, she was able to do that. She was kind of a force of nature, I would say.
She was great. We had her on a couple of years ago. It was her and Rita Sudman.
Uh-huh.
And they got in. We let them do a debate on the radio, and it was awesome. I mean, absolutely awesome. But at the end of the show, they both agreed on something, which was great. I mean, that's the point. You got to hear everybody's opinion and see what it is. And again, nobody can have 100% of everything, and you're never going to get the world to agree 100%. Everybody's on the same page. It's not going to happen. But you got to come up with some alternatives or some compromise, and like. You know, like Chris said, right? You know, we read your blog this morning, and you talked about that. The collaboration has to happen.
Yeah.
And I want to see somebody step up and do it, not just for political gain, but for their job. And I don't see that happening, at least here in California.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, I think Governor Brown tried to lead it on. The problem with the Delta Tunnel issue is that, I mean, that's just a long-standing, bitter thing. And there are, you know, I mean, it goes back to 1982 when, you know, the voters voted on the peripheral canal, which was the canal version of the Delta Tunnel, essentially, and it got voted down, like 98% to 2%.
Yeah.
I mean, when do you ever see a ballot measure nowadays go 98-2, right? They're not there from like 40-60.
Yeah.
It was resoundingly defeated. And, you know, there are people that are just against it. They're probably not even sure why. They just know they are. You're from Northern California. You're against it. And I don't mean to make it sound like they don't have valid reasons. They have a lot of valid reasons.
Right.
You know, there are a lot of valid concerns. But I think it's really going to be hard to get that that thing, any kind of Delta conveyance project approved. It's probably going to still, you know, will always be opposition. The voluntary agreements, that was began by Governor Brown administration, continued into the Newsom administration. You know, and they are trying to, you know, get people together and solve the problem. And it seemed to be moving towards that, except, you know, Newsom has been very unclear, and he doesn't really seem, you know, in my opinion, to have a really solid water policy. So he kind of, you know, moves in the wind a little bit, and it's hard to put it down. And, you know, his filing of that lawsuit, you know, he vetoed SB1, which the environmentalists really wanted him to pass, which would have, you know, rebuked the Trump administration. He vetoed that, and then he turned around and sued on the biological opinion. So, I mean, that's kind of like, you know, a reversal in a sense.
I think Becerra had a lot to say about that, though. He put his.
Huh?
I think Javier Becerra had a lot to say about filing the suits. But, you know, you also have the issue of the administration's changing all the time, and it's like the president of the United States or anything else. How do you turn a country around in 4 years? It's pretty hard to do, right? And the same thing with the state government. You know, when they get elected for the 4 years, I think it should be longer that they can serve, maybe a 6-year term or something. But you also have that issue that, you know, you have one governor, another governor comes in and he wants something different, and you start putting all these things in, and the next thing you know, it's 15 years down the road and you're still arguing about it.
Yeah, you know, and we also have to take into consideration, you know, water, it's an important issue. It's very important to people like you and me.
Yep.
But it's also not the only issue. There are numerous issues, you know, the transportation, the roads, you know, the school system, the health insurance. I mean, there are so many things. I think it's hard for a governor to come in, and they can't be master of it all. I think we were sort of got used to, like, Governor Schwarzenegger and Governor Brown, who they knew they were going to do something on water, and they made moves, and they were very consistent. And I think Newsom's priorities, that they're elsewhere. You know, I think, you know, from because I'm into water, I say, oh, that's bad, very bad. But as a person, you know, I think you sometimes need to see these priorities change at the top level, because, you know, other things need attention too.
Yeah, well, we look as a California resident, right? We look at the news and we read Maven's notebook and we see all the blogs come out, right? I mean, last week you predicted, because of Trump's visit here in the California, that, you know, after he left, right, the what would happen post Trump's visit, right, and what would happen with the voluntary agreements, and, you know, the Delta plan and all this other stuff. I mean, it hasn't calmed down at all. I mean, you talk about what a week in California water, right? I mean,
oh yeah, it just goes on, and on.
Yeah.
And now we have, you know, also the lack of precipitation. Although it looks like we're moving into a wetter pattern.
It does.
there's some rain coming, you know, next week that I guess there it will be scattered over the weekend, but the bigger story
Tuesday
will
and
come
Wednesday,
the
yeah.
following week.
Yeah. yeah. Which is good.
Yeah, we were commenting at the beginning of the show that our weather this week, it was, you know, 60 degrees. The next day it was 80. The next day it was 60. The next day it was 81. Today it was 88, right? It's like the stock market.
yeah. Well, this weather whiplash stuff, it's hard to deal with. It's hard for plants to deal with. I'm glad we didn't try to grow a winter garden. They'd be so confused.
well. You know, I just really hope, you know, your point was well taken. There's so many things to worry about running a government, whether it's a local, a state, or federal. I agree with all of that. I just think and in each of those things, you need to really siphon a couple off. Maybe it's the top five, the top 10. And I always said, get the biggest and brightest people to work on those 10 different ones in the different categories and solve that, and then bring another one that floats up to the top to do that. Because if you can't work on everything all the time, it's never going to work. It hasn't worked.
No, you can't. And I will say this. I do see that Newsom, he does have priorities.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure water is one of them. But he's been bringing in, you know, people to help him on key issues that he's concerned at. I'm trying to think of what one of those are, but, you know, I don't pay a whole lot of attention. But I see all the appointments come through, and I can see he's appointed himself some policy advisors in some other areas. And I do think he finally got a water policy person there. But I think, you know, to be honest, I think his priorities are, they're something else. And, you know, I mean, I think you should pay attention to water because it's the most important thing. But, you know, but there are other important things, too. And sometimes the change of leadership it's a change, you know, it's a chance to get a fresh brain
yeah.
on something.
I mean, Newsom said the other day his two of his biggest priorities is homeless and the second is housing.
Yeah. And those are two big problems that
yep.
we need that need to be solved.
Yep.
You know, so.
But couple out with water, and if you don't have water, the housing and homelessness isn't going to be solved either.
No, that's true, and so we work on that. We work on that too. But yeah, it's a big issue. Lots of stuff. Yeah, his state of the state didn't even mention water.
I know. So an observation again from a California resident, right? Which is what I am. You know, some of the remarks that Newsom makes when he gets asked questions seem like shoot from the hip kind of things. It kind of questions whether I realize that if he knows all these programs that are in place, you know, they're not new. The issues that come up aren't new. These programs are 10, 15, 20 years old. They haven't been updated in that many years as well, right? So, I mean, there's a lot of work to do in this state.
Yep.
Yeah, there is. No worries. We're not going to solve any of it anytime soon. So we'll all
darn.
Have our job.
Darn. All right. Hey, Chris, well, great to hear from you this week. We're getting up to the bottom of the hour here. And, of course, we've got to pay some bills with some commercials and then bring in our next guest.
Our listeners should go to mavensnotebook.com.
Yep, absolutely.
They can subscribe. If they want to be a supporter of that, they can do so. All the information's on their website, and I tell you, it's a great. We love everything you do every day. I tell you, we read it every day, so we can keep up.
Thank you.
So,
that's what I like to hear.
Well, you got us for life.
Cool.
Except I don't know how long we got on the street. But
yeah,
you got us for life.
That's nice of you to say. Let's quantify that, would you? If you don't mind. Hey, Chris, have a great week. We'll talk to you next week, huh?
Okay, will do.
Thank you, Chris.
Good evening, everyone.
Good evening. And we're stick around. We're going to be back with some great guests, and we'll be back in just 2 minutes.
To take a water break and talk some water. Irrigation. such a refreshing topic. As more and more markets face water restrictions, your customers may be hungry, or should I say thirsty, for water-saving products? For new installations, add options like drip irrigation, controllers that respond to weather data, pressure-regulating heads, or heads with check valves. They all provide easy ways to differentiate your bids and win more jobs. Or for an extra stream of revenue, offer existing customers upgrades like high-efficiency nozzles, rotary nozzles, or Wi-Fi-based controllers. Because when you help your customers save water, you make a world of difference for the earth and your bottom line at the same time. We'll drink to that.
If you knew there was a pipe cement that works better than the one you're currently using, is better for you and the environment, and costs the same or less, would you buy it? Well, no-brainer, right? Weldon, the trusted leader in solvent cements for over 60 years, is pleased to introduce a new line of solvent cements that does all that. Introducing the Eco Series line of solvent cements for PVC piping systems. Not only does it work great and set fast, it also has 30% lower solvent emissions and less smelly fumes, a better workplace environment when you're installing pipes. But don't just take our word for it. EcoSeries products are the only solvent cements that are Green Seal certified for environmental innovation for effective performance, improved working conditions, and for use with potable water. Now available in a medium-bodied fast-setting blue formula, 905 Eco, and a regular-bodied fast-setting clear formula, 900 Eco. Pick up a can today from your local distributor and see, smell, and feel the difference, just like Joe Sweat, president of Sunrise Irrigation, did. He said, after using Weldon's 905 Eco, we immediately noticed the application was smooth and there was noticeably less odor than other blue solvent cements on the market. The guys love it. To learn more about Eco solvent cements from Weldon, visit the website at www.weldon.com or call the technical service hotline at 877-477-8327. That's 877-477-8327.
Well, welcome back to the second half of the Water Zone, and we're glad everybody's listening in. We have some great guests. Hopefully we have two guests. We'll find out in a second. We have Mr. Bill Alley, Dr. Alley. I should give him the attention and recognition he should have. He's an internationally recognized authority on groundwater and an environmental science writer. He was chief of the Office of Groundwater for the U.S. Geological Survey for almost two decades. Bill has interacted with the EPA in numerous ways for more than 40 years, and his experience has allowed for an objective, critical look at the agency. His wife, Rosemary, is a freelance writer with extensive writing and public speaking experience. Bill and Rosemary previously collaborated on Too Hot to Touch. I know what that book is, but I'll let him explain that title to the audience so they don't think it's something different. And the problem of high-level nuclear waste and high and dry, and mean the challenges of the world's growing dependence on groundwater. And the Alleys divide their time between San Diego, California, and Longmont, Colorado. So those are two great places to live.
Two great places to be.
So, Bill, welcome to the show. Is your wife with you?
I'm here. This is Rosemary.
Oh, I'm sorry. They didn't tell us that.
We're both here.
Great. Good evening to both of you. Thank you very much. I know, Bill, you've been on the show before, and it was excellent. We had a lot of comments the last time you were on. And just so you know, I didn't get the book yet. They said it was supposed to be here today, but I didn't get that. But I read some of the other things that your publisher had sent to us, and we want to talk about that. You have this new book called The War on the EPA, America's Endangered Environmental Protections. And had some good people who made comments about that, and I have to ask you. I know we had mentioned Ms. McCarthy from the EPA former administration,
the
leader.
Yeah, former
Gina.
Yeah.
Gina, and you had interfaced with her a few times. Is that correct?
She basically gave us an endorsement for the book.
Right.
Yeah. I can't say I know her personally.
I had to send you. Did you get the picture I sent you?
I did see the picture, so I see that you had a close conversation with her.
Yeah.
Doesn't sound like it was a successful one, though.
I'm still arguing that with the EPA. she's really a nice lady, and aside from that, she's a very smart lady. And we had great conversation. And it's okay that we can have an in-depth discussion about different things. And all, you know, just for our audience, we were talking about EPA WaterSense label and the EPA Energy Star. And our products, for example, are EPA WaterSense approved, but I also felt that some of the products that we have can also be classified as EPA Energy Star. And that was the discussion that I've had with her and her staff, and it's still an ongoing for the last 5 years. I'm still negotiating or trying to negotiate with that to try to make that happen. But persistence is important, I believe. So what motivated both of you to write the book?
Well, I'm Rosemary. I'll go ahead and start that. Bill, right after, a few weeks after Trump was elected, Bill was at a meeting at the EPA in Washington, D.C., the National Groundwater, no, the
Drinking Water Advisory Council.
Take it.
Yeah, so I came back from the EPA meeting. You know, I saw how downtrodden everybody was. And so we decided we were going to write a book about EPA. And we kind of went from there.
Well,
yeah,
we...
and let me continue that just a little bit.
Sure.
So we both agreed immediately that, you know, this is an extremely demoralized agency. And so, yes, we would do a book. But what I discovered shortly after we started working on it, I just started asking people, so what does the EPA do? And most people, there was, you know, sort of a moment of silence, and people would say they protect the environment. And the most sophisticated, fine-tuned answer I got was they protect air and water. So, we, you know, that's when we discovered that most people don't have any sense at all, this immense challenge that our Environmental Protection Agency has.
No, was that people? Was that people that you asked at the EPA, or people just in general?
No, just people, just in my everyday life,
right.
Just, you know, kind of doing this little poll of what do people know about the EPA, and I discovered almost nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So we also wrote the book with that very much in mind, to make it a good readable. We have a lot of good stories in there, some very positive stories. You know, EPA has some very impressive accomplishments.
Absolutely.
Under its belt.
Yeah.
And to educate people about how important this agency is.
Yeah. So, Bill and Rosemary, this is Chris. It might seem fair to say that some people would probably expect to get a similar sort of response, a poll response for many U.S. Government agencies, if you ask them the same question, maybe. But, you know, Rob and I are sitting here, and we have you know, the little excerpt from the book and the explanation. So maybe for our listeners, you can kind of you know, give the 30,000 view look of really what's in the book. And, you know, we know that it covers some of the daunting challenges that the EPA has. So from your perspective, how would you describe the contents of the book?
Yeah, so actually it evolved a little bit as we were writing it. We started out by sort of writing around what we thought were the six big acts, you know, Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act, and so forth. But then we decided that along the way, we started to realize that one of the major themes that we had was just how challenging it is to develop regulations. And so that's one of our themes, I would say, in the book, is just some people think they're just sort of laid out there willy-nilly, and actually there's a very, you know, strong, difficult process to go through. And then the second thing is that really the dependence of EPA on both its scientific capability and its scientific integrity really are key. And those have both been under siege over the past 4 years. And actually, by the way, we've written the book in the context of not just the past 4 years, but really from the very beginning to now, and the challenges that the agency has faced. And then I think the third thing is to lay out the case about why we, you know, our rivers aren't burning. Air pollution is not as bad as it was. It's still a problem in many areas, California in particular. But there's still a lot of need for a strong Environmental Protection Agency.
Yeah, and I mean really, we could say that there's as strong a need as ever for a strong Environmental Protection Agency. I just want to add also what Bill said about the regulations, that another kind of theme we have in the book is, you know, EPA has been demonized certainly in the last 3.5 years, or, well, during even the campaign, you know, over-regulating. This is an agency that's just way out of control with its regulations. when the truth is almost exactly the opposite. And in what's involved in a regulation, developing a regulation and a standard is an extremely challenging process. We compare it in the book with climbing K2. I mean, the studies that have to be done, the and then there has to be the cost-benefit arguments that have to be addressed. And for an example, no new chemicals have been regulated in drinking water for over two decades. Agriculture is the major source of major non-point source pollution. It's largely unregulated. And there's still no agreement on what constitutes the waters of the United States. So, you know, in terms of the over-regulation argument, we really did develop that to help people understand that that's just not the case.
Yeah. Right. So, you know, essentially what you're, not only do you cover all the issues and as you described just now, but really, quote unquote, why it matters, right? It's important to the average American.
Right. Yeah, and that is such a key thing, because at the end of the day, I mean, people are only going to care about our environmental protection if they understand what's in it for me. Yeah. And, you know, it's just the same as high school or school kids, you know, like, why do I need to know this? You know, what's in it for me? And so, that's a very important part of the book to, you know, really help people understand the importance. Yeah.
Well, Chris and I are very much involved with the EPA. We deal with a lady named Veronica Bledy. I don't know if either one of you know her. She's the chief of the Water Sense Program. And we do a lot of work with them and help them come up with you know, part of their standards, mm-hmm. and things like that. So we totally believe in that.
In our day jobs.
Yeah, in our real jobs.
Right. That's a success story. That's a real. We don't cover the Water Sense program per se, mm-hmm. but we mention it actually as a very successful program, and the Energy Star program, which is a joint effort with
Absolutely.
Energy.
Oh, absolutely.
Very. You know, if you look at the benefit costs, they're huge.
Oh yes. You know, I see. You know, I didn't do the in-depth study like you. Both of you have done, and I appreciate you did that. Like I said, I was really anxious to get the book so I could start reading it today, but hopefully it came after we left work today, but hopefully it'll be there tomorrow. You know, one of the things, you know, as you mentioned, what people think the EPA does, you know, yes, they did put a lot of work into coming up with standards and things like that, but it's almost like in California here when they pass all these, you know, 800 laws a year. How do you go after those? How do you make sure that they're enforced? You know, we had in 2012, they came out with AB 1888 talking about that you had to have weather-based irrigation controllers starting that year. And that's never happened. I mean, nobody forced that to be a thing. You know, like water in Flint, Michigan, water in Central California, why is there contamination in those things? And how come nobody's shutting that down? I mean, I totally believe that the EPA has a responsibility and a job, and they have a tough job to do. And I don't believe it's the leaders of that organization through the years. I don't know how far does it go to the people who really have to put the brakes on things like that. Can you maybe, from your input and your research, can you kind of tell me a little bit more about that?
Okay, so you mentioned two instances. Which we actually cover, okay. in a chapter called Environmental Justice, the Flint, Michigan, and the Central Valley, and basically the disadvantaged communities in
right.
California and the poor drinking water quality. And so in the Flint, Michigan example, that is a failure of basically the regional office not taking charge of that problem. So that's one of the major causes of that problem was the regional office just didn't pay attention to their own guy, actually, who was raising alarms about it. And so they didn't, you know, we talk about Williams Ruckelshaus referred to the gorilla in the closet. In other words, the EPA was there. The states have a lot of responsibility, but really this particularly headquarters was the gorilla in the closet, meaning that would come out in the event that they really needed to, you know, start to get out the hammer.
Yeah, and Ruckelshaus, he was the first leader of the EPA, correct?
He was the first, and he came back after Gorsuch actually left EPA under Reagan. He brought Ruckelshaus back to reinvigorate, to you know, bring something back to the agency in terms of a morale. The other one you mentioned, the disadvantaged communities. So that one's a little more, you know, EPA has resources that they can apply to help with those kinds of situations. But also it drills down a little bit more into the state's responsibility and so forth. And so in this particular case, you had a group, particularly the Community Water Center, right, that really for 13 years battled to get help to these people, and they finally succeeded under Newsom most recently to provide at least some funding so they can try to get these small systems proper treatment so people are not drinking high concentrations of nitrate, arsenic, uranium, and so forth.
You know, I think another part of the answer to, you know, why, you know, you can pass a law or a regulation, but if you don't enforce it, it's not going to go very far. That, I mean, there has been from day one this constant battle between EPA and business interests. And, you know, it's just, I mean, that certainly is part of the answer, that it's been a balancing act for the agency for 50 years. You know, they're coming up on their 50-year anniversary here in April. And,
right.
So, yeah.
So you've emphasized already in your comments that how difficult, how challenging it is for any agency, the EPA included, to develop and establish, you know, regulations. And often from a you know, outsider viewpoint, we look at those as saying, well, they're doing that. That's really not going to make much sense, or that's not going to happen, right? So it's difficult. Can you give us some examples, and I'm sure there are many, of why it's so difficult?
Well, you have to make a case, okay? And that case is going to be challenged. It goes through a process of, you know, you have to write it up and you have to get public comments. And in some of these cases, you know, they're gathering a million public comments on like the Waters of the United States, I suspect, had something of that order associated with it. So then you have to address those comments. You have to put it in the context of the regulations that Congress has passed. So, you know, and then there are a lot of challenges from both sides.
Sure.
You know, industry can challenge, and many of these acts have provisions for citizen suits. So, you know, citizen groups can also battle out with you. So oftentimes it's a long, lengthy rulemaking process.
Sure.
And this is
go ahead.
This is being exacerbated with the war on science. And of course, you know, there was a big march a couple of years ago, mainly focused on climate change. But scientific expertise and scientific findings have been seriously hampered. And, you know, and so it makes it more difficult yet to justify a study that EPA has conducted. And of course, they do many for any kind of regulation they're talking about, any kind of standards, because you can have somebody coming along who doesn't have a clue what they're talking about, just talking off the top of their head and, you know, equal time, you know, for that kind of thing. And it's severely hampering the ability to for the EPA to fulfill its mandate.
Yeah.
Sure. There's been big ones, right, you know, that have come down, like the Clean Air Act and things like that you were mentioning. But, you know, today they're challenging things like, you know, PFAS, right, the forever chemicals. Where in the process is that these days with the EPA?
Okay, so that's actually a chapter.
Ah,
forever
good.
Chemicals. So that is the biggest challenge probably that EPA has at the moment, because there's, first of all, there's a fair number of them, as they're called forever chemicals for a reason. They're very persistent in the environment. They are standards that they have, or the health advisors that they have, are in the parts per trillion level. You know, most things like dechlorinated solvents and so forth have been more in the parts per billion. So we're very, very low levels that they seem to have some health effects, and a broad array of health effects, for that matter. So, and there have been, you know, the main issues are main issues probably were firefighting foam, because you have all these military bases that have been to having practices putting out oil-based fires with this fire foam that nobody ever collected up. It just seeped into the ground. So you have massive groundwater contamination around the United States that has to be cleaned up somehow. And then also some big manufacturing plants have had a problem. And then
sure.
A lot of, you know, we get exposure to PFAS in many ways. We get it to wrap around your hamburger, through floss in your teeth, many ways. So that's the Scotch Guard that you use to keep your couch from, was used to keep your couch from, if somebody spilled milk on it, you know. So it's a big challenge today. And it's been we tell the story of Hoosick Falls, New York. Which was one of the first cases. And just these poor people, you know, the standard, what they were calling the advisory levels or the standards kept changing. They couldn't get help because financial help because they it was not a regulated contaminant and they only had funding in the state for regulated contaminants. And so it was a several year, nightmare for the
sure,
poor people
sure.
There.
Do you think, for example, with the contaminated water, not in Flint, but let's just talk California for a second, or anywhere, do you believe that, or do you think that the states shouldn't control that, or the local people shouldn't be in charge of that? For example, there's a lot of small water agencies in Central California. I'm using that as an example. Maybe have 3 employees to that agency. And the water is contaminated and dirty. And I know there's been a fight about the big guys, big water agencies coming in, taking over and spending gazillions of dollars, to fix it up so they can deliver the clean water. But do you believe there should be a bigger, somebody of more importance coming in and telling the regulators at that local site that, hey, you can't do this because it's not going to be right for delivering water? I think... I personally believe everybody in this country, no matter who they are, where they come from, legal, illegal, whatever, should have the right to clean, healthy water. And I mean, that's the least we can do as human beings. But it hasn't stopped putting little tiny agencies with 3 and 4 and 5 mom and pop kind of places in place. Should the government then be in charge of all of that? I mean, I don't know who has the clout to come in and make those things stop.
Well, it's kind of a tricky question you're asking here, but my thoughts on that are, you know, that was probably the main reason that justified the creation of the EPA in the first place, that previously environmental protections was left up to the states.
Yeah.
Well, states have huge vested interests in attracting business to their state and hanging on to it. And so if a state is too... prescriptive about environmental protections, then the company would just move to an easier state, a state where, you know, they could basically do whatever they wanted.
Right.
This was a national problem. And so when EPA was created, if you weren't allowed to be dumping, you know, raw sewage into the waterway or chemicals or whatever, you know, it didn't matter where you were, you couldn't do it. You had to pay a fine, and you couldn't do it. So it kind of evened the playing field in terms of protecting the environment.
So, Rosemarie, you mentioned a little earlier about the war on science, right? I was really intrigued by that comment that you made. So maybe you can define for some of our listeners. I mean, there's a lot of challenges that many agencies have, including the EPA. What are some of the biggest ones that are coming up now, and how are they, you know, how are they being tackled or hindered under the current administration?
Well, the one that immediately comes to mind, and I'm going to get to Bill this in a second here, but immediately comes to mind is the climate change issue. And here you have people in the administration and elsewhere as well who don't have a clue what they're talking about, demanding equal time with scientists who have worked long and hard to understand a very challenging problem. And it's this attitude that everybody should get a say and everybody should be able to have their opinion this is a fairly new attitude in this country. I mean, you know, certainly in my lifetime, until the last maybe 20 years or so, scientists were respected. If there was a scientific finding, people would really sit up and pay attention to that. And now it's all up for debate.
What do you say? Because I'm thinking we're close to the same age here. I know attitudes have changed in the last 20 to 30 years, but I also see. What do you say to scientists that say one thing and another scientist who says something 180 degrees opposite? And they're both, I'll just for this discussion say they both have PhDs and they're both experts in their field. How do you put those together, and how do they compromise? I guess.
Yeah. So everybody's not going to agree with everybody else,
right.
And there are going to be different studies that show different things. In fact, you see that in the PFAS. But the states all have these different standards because they're using different criteria,
right,
to set them. So I think you have to let that play out, and you have to judge whether they're speaking as opinions or whether they're speaking with facts to stand behind them.
Yeah,
you know.
I mean, my technical prowess is engineering, and I always used to go around. And I still say, "In God we trust," although there's bring data. And
that's a good one.
And then my other one is, you can't walk on water if you don't get out of the boat.
Right.
So I mean, I really believe in science because that's my background. And I listen to, and I'm not picking a side today or with this or that. It's just, it's interesting when I go see things, just like the little fishies in the delta, the smelt. I went to a meeting once in Metropolitan Water. And they had a company come in, and the guy made a presentation how when they measured the delta in the original study that they spent millions of dollars, that it's wrong because they didn't do it at a certain time of day, they didn't do it in a certain area, they didn't do it at different depths. And after he spoke, it was like 180 degrees different than what the original report that they came out with. And both the first company that did that report years ago, they had PhD guy, I mean, smart scientists, biologists. And this guy had the same thing. It was like, how do you get that kind of difference? And, you know, I do believe, like you said, with the standards being set, I know when we work with the water sensing, we help develop with the Irrigation Association what the standards should be. How do you test the controllers? What's going to be the, you know, the specifications for those things so everybody's tested on the same level? That has to happen, just like you guys said. I totally believe in that. But it's real hard today, and I don't know if it's the internet that's causing the problem or anything else. Just like Rosemary said, you get these different opinions, and you want to believe somebody, but sometimes it's hard to know which one's telling the right story and who has the data behind
it. Well, my rule of thumb is, and I tell this to people, I say this, it's one of my mantras, is vet your sources. You know, just because you read it on the internet does not make it true. Bet your sources, and it's not hard. Just Google whoever wrote it, and you can find something out about that person. And if there's a political motivation behind it, or somehow connected with some kind of political agenda, well, then you want to maybe be a little more suspicious.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. So your book is out. It's published by, if you can tell us that, and where can they find those things?
Well, it's published by Roman and Littlefield,
mm-hmm.
But you can find it on, just do a search on the war on the EPA alley.
Amazon.
It's on Amazon or Barnes & Noble, Indie Books, and so forth. And you can also, we have a website people could go to. It's very simple, alleyandalley.com, A-L-L-E-Y. And alley.com.
Wow. Yeah, I could spend, you probably don't have the time, but I would love to spend a week with you just listening on all what you've researched, and so, because it's really interesting to me.
It's a fascinating topic, actually.
Yeah, we're looking forward to reading the book, definitely.
Yep.
Yeah, it's a timely topic also with the election coming up this year for people to be just, you know, our goal is certainly for people to be better informed about what's at stake here.
Yes. Well, in fairness, it's been a political week, so
that is
sure
true.
Has.
Well, we appreciate you coming on. And again, everybody, go get the book, The War on EPA. It's a great book, and both the alleys are wonderful people. And we're very blessed that you were on the show today. We appreciate it.
Okay. Well, thanks so much,
Robert.
Thanks. So, everybody, remember to hear more episodes of The Water Zone. Be sure to download Turf's Up Radio app and.